morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Darren Grizz of Chiesa, Shahini, and John Tomasi, counsel for Appellant Everest Re Insurance Company. Harmonization of the two statutes at issue in this case was imminently possible and required, and it wasn't done by the district court. That decision should be reversed. If it's possible that this court finds also that harmonization is not possible, then we're faced with a situation where we're creating new California law, and that issue should be certified to the California Supreme Court. However, as stated, harmonization is imminently possible. Everest lodged a supported, factually indisputed claim that the subdivision improvement agreement and bonds under which Everest has been sued were tainted by the conflicts of interest in violation of Section 1090 of the California Government Code. 1090 has its very own statute of limitations, the latest of the three possibly applicable, enacted in 2007, specifically and exclusively for 1090 claims.
Can I ask you a question? I'm a little bit unclear on whether the assignment and assumption agreement is at issue, because the district court found that the statute of limitations in 65009 applied to that agreement, and that Section 66499.37 statute of limitations applied to the subdivision agreement, and she certified both questions. So both statutes are actually before us. So why wouldn't the AA agreement be part of this appeal if we're only looking at the AA agreement for the 65009 statute of limitations?
As this appeal has progressed, Your Honor, we have brought more focus to the second count of our dismissed counterclaim, which sought to void the SIA, Subdivision Improvement Agreement, and importantly, also the bonds, which Everest clearly is a party to that contract.
And why is that? You don't care about the AA because that's just like reassigning responsibilities, or what?
The AA agreement issue becomes more of an issue if we have been found to be liable under the bond. But yes, it is a less significant issue, and we have a harder time withstanding, if I'm being honest.
Why is that? Because you have the Honig case from the Supreme Court that says that multiple agreements are treated as one.
There is a way. There's the Honig case, and there is also Thompson versus Call, which says you look at a complex transaction as a whole. So we would be able to argue under 1090 jurisprudence that you look at the entire body of these agreements as one unified transaction.
But you think you're weak on statutory standing on the AA?
We're just not as strong under the AA agreement as we are with respect to the bonds in the subdivision improvement agreement, which is incorporated into our bonds by reference.
Well, what I don't understand is you've asked, or I guess the defendant, you're the defendant here, you asked for the certification of a legal question. So it almost doesn't matter what you want anymore, because the question you asked to certify was certified, and that's what is before us.
I thought the motion to certify did not raise the first counterclaim. Am I wrong about that?
The focus of our motion has been the second count of our counterclaim, which relates to our request for a declaration voiding the bonds in the SIA.
Okay. I'm reading from 2 ER 19. It says the defendant moves to certify the following question: whether the 90-day limitations period set forth in California Government Code Section 65009 and 66499.37 bar a contracting party from seeking to void public contracts tainted with prohibited financial conflicts of interest pursuant to 1090 and 1092. And then that says defendant's motion to certify is granted. I don't see anything in the district court's order carving out 65009.
There's nothing in the order, and both the district court and the parties admittedly have conflated 66-499-37 and 65-009. There is case law from the California courts that say that those two statutory provisions are very similar and have been applied in similar situations. But for purposes of this appeal, Everest is...
Then explain to me, why did you ask for certification of 65009 if that's not what you wanted? If you wanted us only to look at the SIA, you could have said certify only 66499.37. But that's not what you asked for in your motion, and that's not what you were granted.
And I'm not intending, Your Honor, to walk back that request. I think that there are grounds, and Your Honor stated accurately that Honig, that Thompson versus Call, that the Stigall case all point to 1090 jurisprudence allowing for or permitting or requiring the court to look at the transaction as a whole in terms of determining whether or not a conflict of interest has arisen. So that is the basis for our request. And the district court dismissed both of our counterclaims, both the first count and the second count. And Her Honor below did do an analysis of 65009 with respect to the AA agreement. So we're not in any way trying to walk that back, but the focus of our appeal, we brought more focus to the second count, which seeks to void the SIA and the bonds.
So you're not raising your third counterclaim, which is a conflict of interest on the AA agreement.
That's true, Your Honor.
Why should that matter when we have a certified question? We can answer the certified question, and it does raise 65009.
I think it does matter. I mean, I would argue, Your Honor, that 65009 and 66499.37 are irrelevant for purposes of our claims that these contracts violated 1090. I think it's an easier presentation to demonstrate why the 1090 should apply to the SIA and bonds, because that's the contract that those are the contracts that we've been sued under, which is why we're seeking to avoid them defensively pursuant to 1090.
Can I ask a different question? You're relying that the project at issue doesn't involve housing. If it did involve housing, would that make the 90-day statute of limitations apply?
Well, our response regarding housing is that is a part of the chapeau of 65009, talking about the intent of that statute. And it does relate to the housing crisis in California. Our position is, regardless of whether or not this is a development of warehouses, which it is, or housing, the 90-day limitations period, according to both Hensler and Travis, if you want to look at either the 66499 or 65009, the intention of that 90-day statute of limitations is to give certainty as to local zoning and planning enactments, where the claim itself is arises by virtue of the enactment that was made. There's nothing to discover. Those are the words exactly from Hensler. And that's why a 90-day limitations period is workable in those situations. And tellingly, I would submit, the city of Cala Mesa has not sued Everest in connection with a legislative decision. The city of Cala Mesa has sued Everest pursuant to agreements that were entered in between Oak Valley and the city of Cala Mesa, and to which Everest issued bonds. And the district.
Why are statutes of limitations regarding any government contract more specific than statutes of limitations involving only land use development?
Well, the first analysis that must happen is whether or not these two statutes can be harmonized. As we stated in our briefs, and as I'm stating now, Hensler and Travis say, provide a test for when 65009 and 66499.37 should apply. Does this case arise from a planning and zoning matter, or does it arise from Subdivision Map Act? That can be harmonized with 1090, which deals exclusively with contract claims. We're talking about which is more specific if we've already gotten past the analysis that they can't be harmonized. Now we're talking about tiebreakers. And there's multiple tiebreakers that the court below did not consult. Your Honor was just referring to which of these statutes is more specific. Now, if we're doing that analysis, we found no harmonization. That, as a matter of fact, would have to mean that a 1090 claim would also be subject to the 65009 or 66499.37 claims. That means that 1090 claims, and the case law supports this, would be a subset of a larger body of claims under the Land Use and Subdivision Map Act 90-day limitations period. Therefore, as a matter of fact, it would have to be more specific. And I would also say that 1092B was enacted, and it's limited only to claims under this section. And it's limited to who can make those claims, which are parties to the contract. Now, we relied on Sandiegans to say the court expressly held that only parties to the contracts can make these claims. And that's confirmed by the words of the statute, and it's confirmed by the California Supreme Court. They use it as a standing argument. There's no conceivable basis that we as a party sued, having issued the bonds, don't have standing in this case to raise a 1092B claim. There's, including the specificity tie-breaking rule, there's four that the court, if you can't harmonize these statutes, which, as we stated in our papers, you can and should harmonize these statutes. But reversal is also required because there's four tie-breaking rules that were not consulted by the court below. First, there was a implied repeal of 1092B in connection with these land use cases. There was a inability or failure by the district court to recognize that Her Honor was finding a redundancy here by saying that there was overlap. The 90-day limitations period for 65009 was 1983 enacted. For 66499.37, that was 1995. And in our case, 1092B was enacted in 2007. So we are dealing with the more specific and later enacted statute. I'm going to reserve it unless the court has any questions for rebuttal.
All right. We'll give you 2 minutes on rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Stephen Nagai for Appellee City of Cala Mesa. And may it please the court. I want to start by answering Judge Koh's question about which of the two limitations period is more specific. And it's the 90-day limitations period. As Judge Koh prefaced in her question, these two limitations period overlap insofar as they govern contracts. And whereas 1092 applies to every contract, the 90-day limitations period applies to subsets of those contracts, specifically those involving land use decisions. Everest's position that somehow because...
Well, what if I disagree with you? I mean, government land use decision, you could challenge that any which way versus a conflict of interest solely in a government contract. That's more narrow.
Yeah, so Everest's position about what is more specific is untenable. If Everest's position is true, then the broad reach of the 90-day limitations period, which apply to any action or proceeding, is actually used against it because every cause of action that is pertains to a specific claim would be more specific.
Counsel, I don't even see why this is about land use. And this is a very simplistic question, I guess. Your complaint states six claims for relief, all of which are breach of written contract. So it's purely a contract claim. And you're saying, you owe us money. And they say, well, we don't owe you money because the contract is void. This seems like a normal contract dispute to me. There's nothing on the line that the government is being asked to do other than not collect dollars from Everest. So I why is this even arguably a challenge to a governmental action as distinct from an ordinary dispute about whether the contract is or is not enforceable under the statutory and other state requirements for a contract?
Well, because this question arises from the counterclaim, we are looking at the nature of the counterclaim, not the city's claim.
Right, and the second counterclaim says this contract that you're asking us to pay under, these contracts, are void because of a conflict of interest. And so we don't have to pay you. So why isn't that sort of the beginning and the end?
Because those contracts involve land use decisions. They are inextricably intertwined. So there's ramifications.
At this point, what are they asking the government to undo other than trying to collect from them?
The subdivision improvement agreement. That goes beyond just the bonds. The subdivision improvement agreement contemplates more than just the bonds. It contemplates how the improvements would be constructed, how the subdivisions would be parceled out. So invalidating the entire agreement would not just invalidate the bonds, it would invalidate the approval on what the city had in mind for that subdivision. And that's the point here, is that Everest is invalidating more than just their bonds. The development agreement is a complex and unique agreement pertaining specifically to land use. If you invalidate that agreement, you're not just invalidating the financial aspect of it, you're invalidating the city's policy choices with how it wants to use that land. And that's the same with the subdivision improvement agreement. So while it might be narrowly framed as a challenge to bonds or the financial aspect of it, it implicates much more. It implicates the land use decisions and policy choices of the governing body.
You know, your answering brief starts with all this flowery language about the California housing crisis, but what's at issue here is an industrial warehouse or warehouses in a tractor-trailer parking lot. So I don't even see how those 65009 and 66499.37 are even applicable.
Your Honor, the statutes themselves do not distinguish between housing and non-housing projects. So a ruling that exempts or has Section 1090 take precedence over the 90-day limitations period would apply to housing projects, even if housing isn't implicated here.
Well, would you say it's inconsistent with the legislative purpose? If I look at all the legislature findings and purpose, I don't see anything about tractor-trailer parking lots and industrial warehouses. You would agree it's inconsistent with the legislative purpose, right?
I would not concede that, Your Honor. Although there's no housing involved here, real estate does not happen in a vacuum. Housing must have infrastructure. Here, there are public improvements at stake as well. So without public improvements, without the capital improvement projects that are also approved through the same processes to which the 90-day limitations periods apply, housing is still dependent on those real estate developments. So it doesn't all happen in a vacuum. Even if this project doesn't happen to have a housing component to it, it isn't completely untethered to housing in a broader respect.
And that's totally speculative, right? I don't see anything about that in legislative history, right?
I couldn't.
Industrial warehouses and tractor trailer parking lots. are inextricably intertwined with housing. I just don't see that in the legislative history. But let me ask you another question. Do you concede that you did not raise your statutory standing argument in the district court?
Yes, Your Honor. That was not specifically raised in the district court.
Can you spend some time talking about AIDS healthcare? Because obviously the district court spent a lot of time relying on that. You rely upon it on appeal. I mean, you've basically said that decision opined on the same dispute that's at issue here. But I mean, for one thing, the AIDS healthcare organization, they dropped their PRA claim. So I'm not sure that that's the case. But here what we really have is a contract dispute. And that wasn't what was going on in that case. So I mean, I guess maybe you can tell us why.
Sure, yes. So AIDS healthcare, the point of AIDS healthcare following Hensler is that when you look at the allegations in the action, when you look at the nature of the action, what is the gravamen of the case? And California case law has been settled and clear that if the action necessarily involves the invalidation of a land use decision, then the gravamen of the case is an attack or challenge to that land use decision.
But those cases haven't involved a contracting party, right? I mean, I know maybe you have a dispute about whether Everest is, but taking just for the hypothetical, assuming that they are, I mean, why do those cases apply?
Well, because in Hensler, the court instructs that it doesn't really matter what the other claim is, because if the other claim necessarily involves the invalidation of the land use statute, then it is still an attack on that land use decision. And that's consistent with the language of the statutes, which apply to any action or proceeding. It doesn't delineate between causes of action, whether contractual, whether conflicts of interest. It talks about actions and proceedings in their entirety. And so Hensler is consistent with that. So when Hensler instructs that you are to look at the gravamen of the case, if that case attacks or involves the invalidation of a land use decision, then it falls within that statute of limitations under 65,009 and 66,499.37.
What about the dicta in CalAm Water? I mean, because that seemed to be getting much more at what's at issue here. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, CalAm involved a different statutory framework, which was the California's validation statutes. And that statutory framework is much more broad than 65,009 and 66,499.37. So the validation statutes apply to a wide range of contracts, just like Section 1092. So when the court in that case compared the validation statutes to Section 1092, it did note that Section 1092 could be more specific because whereas the validation statutes are used for an entire panoply of contracts, Section 1092 applies to contracts that are tainted with conflict. That's not the case here. Here, 65,009 and 66,499.37 pertain to a smaller subset of contracts than 1092. Which are the land use statute or land use contracts, as opposed to every contract that's governed by Section 1092. I also want to note that the validation statutes don't contain the same sort of sweeping language that the land use statutes have. The land use statutes make it clear, very clear, that any action or proceeding is entirely cut off after 90 days. And it reiterates that point in two places in both statutes. I want to briefly address the issue of whether this should be certified to the California Supreme Court. And I don't think certification here is necessary because, again, there is settled California law on how to make the determination here. You look at the nature of the claim, you determine what the gravamen of it is, and then you apply the statute of limitations applicable to the nature of that claim.
But if we view the gravamen of this dispute as being basically about money and a contract and not about land use, then it's not so clear. or I mean, it just strikes me as interesting that you oppose the certification, and I wonder whether you really think that the California Supreme Court would say that it would overlook the tainting of a contractual arrangement by a conflict of interest in this situation.
Excuse me, Your Honor. I do believe that, Your Honor. I think Hensler was very clear. It was unequivocal that when...
But factually, it was quite different than this. Wasn't it about the map, if I remember correctly? Maybe I'm misremembering among these cases, but...
So the case didn't involve contracts, admittedly, but Hensler cited to a number of cases involving different causes of action. Its point wasn't so much in that particular case that it was a takings action. It wasn't so much that because a takings claim was involved that somehow it didn't supersede the attack on the land use decision.
But the court had no opportunity to consider in that case whether the policies behind the conflict of interest statute and the rights of the contracting parties would override or be more specific or more important than?
I think we can get there with two other cases. With AIDS Healthcare, that case, I understand, doesn't involve contracts, but it did talk specifically about the policy of conflicts of interest and corruption. So in that scenario, the Court of Appeals still held that the limitations period under the land use statutes took precedence over whatever policy underlying the Political Reform Act involving, you know, corruption or conflicts of interest. The other case is the Legacy Group case, which Everest cites in its reply. Now, in that case, it did involve a breach of contract, and the court did say that a breach of contract that didn't involve the land use decision, one that couldn't have been challenged when the agreement was entered into, is not within the 90-day limitations period. But in that case, the court said if that breach of contract claim, if that contract claim could have been brought at the time that the agreement was created, then it does fall within the ambit of 66499.37. And here, it could have, because the conflict allegedly existed at the time the agreement was created. So it does fall within that exception that Legacy Group carved out for a breach of contract claim that involves a land use decision where that claim could have been brought at the inception of that agreement. So when you combine the two cases, AIDS Healthcare says the policy of ferreting out corruption and conflicts of interest in government does not supersede the 90-day limitations period just by virtue of the plain language of those statutes. And then in Legacy Group, the court in dicta said that contract claims that arose at the time that the contract was created must be brought within the same 90-day window.
Thank you.
Oh, I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
The Hensler case referenced is a takings case that had to do with a ridgeline ordinance. There's no conflict of interest at issue in that case. There's no contracts at issue in that case. But the court did provide the test for when 66499.37 should apply. Did the claim arise under the Subdivision Map Act? Now, the Subdivision Map Act does not have a conflict of interest provision, nor does it have a provision voiding even subdivision-type contracts, because why would it? There's a separate statute provided for conflict of interest contract avoidance claims under 1090 and 1092. I'm glad that counsel cited the city of Wasco. One thing I would mention, I believe that counsel took the test from Hensler as applied in Wasco, which is, does the claim arise under the Subdivision Map Act, to make a point suggesting that we should have known about the conflict at the time the contract was issued. There's two responses to that. 1092B was enacted specifically according to the legislative history because the parties to these conflicted relationships often conceal that relationship. And that's exactly what happened in this case. All throughout discovery leading up to trial.
Can I ask you a question? Is it your position that the panel should not address the statute of limitations in 65009 because the assignment agreement is not at issue? Do we not even touch and reach that question?
No, because, Your Honor, it is part of the certified question.
So we do reach it even though the AA agreement is not at issue? I'm very confused by your position, to be honest.
Well,
if it's not at issue because you're saying counterclaim number 3, which is the conflict of interest on the AA, is not at issue, it's not on appeal, and you don't think the AA is at issue, but go ahead and address the statute of limitations in 65009 when that only applies to the AA? Does that seem consistent to you? I'm just unclear on why we would do that.
We have brought focus to the second claim of the amended counterclaim, which, and I'm not answering your question.
Okay, but the second counterclaim was the SIA, conflict of interest.
Yes, Your
Honor. The district court only found that the statute of limitations applicable to the SIA was 66499.37 because that was a subdivision decision. The district court found that 65009 applied to the AA because that was a development agreement and modifications to the development agreement. So you're telling us AA is not at issue, which would mean 65009 is not at issue, but then go ahead and rule on it. I'm really not clear.
Everest would be fine with that limitation so long as we are able to have a decision with respect to the second counterclaim, which relates to 66499.37 and the SIA.
Judge Koh, any other questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, Judge Graber.
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We thank both counsel very much for their helpful arguments in this case. This matter is now submitted, and our court stands in recess until tomorrow. Thank you.
All rise. This court stands in recess until tomorrow at 9 a.m.